This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today looking at medical malpractice in the Commonwealth. With more than 40,000 practicing doctors, according to the Massachusetts Board of Registration in Medicine, how good are we as a state at protecting against and following up on concerns over the dangerous practice of medicine? We started thinking about this after a Boston Globe investigation last week into a New Hampshire-based heart surgeon.
He was promoted as a star surgeon, but his patients didn't know about his troubled history, one that led to one of the worst malpractice settlement records in the country. His disturbing record left a trail of pain, damage, and death, which the hospital seemed to ignore.
That's from a Boston Globe video about their story on Dr. Yvonne Beribu, who worked at Catholic Medical Center in Manchester, New Hampshire. The investigation found that Dr. Beribu settled 21 medical malpractice claims. 14 of those original claims accused Dr. Beribu of contributing to a patient's death. That's the most of any surgeon in the U.S. over the last two decades, according to the Globe. So we want to look at this. And first up, Dr. Douglas Hanto. He is the professor of surgery emeritus at Harvard Medical School and co-chair of the Harvard Center for Bioethics' Surgical Ethics Working Group. Dr. Hanto, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And as we begin, I want to note that I am married to a practicing MD in Massachusetts. So, Dr. Hanto, how extreme is the Beribu case?
Well, I think as the Globe Spotlight story showed, this is way beyond the pale. I mean, there's never been anyone that we've known about that has had this many malpractice suits that have been settled. And I think it really is a travesty that he was allowed to practice as long as he was able to. It really was a failure of the system.
And at the highest level, explain to us what should have happened. We'll go more in depth into the setup in a minute, but just at the highest level, what should have happened?
Well, there were a number of warning signs very early on after he started his practice. He had several malpractice cases settled, four in fact, that were reviewed by the hospital. He was given reprimands. Other physicians and staff within the hospital brought their concerns to the administration. And unfortunately, I think that he was a rainmaker for the hospital. And they just felt that it was more important to keep him operating and the expose of his malpractice would have been a real problem for the hospital. And I think they just were not. They were asleep at the switch.
So the hospital should have stopped it.
Well, the hospital and the QA people, it's a little different in private hospitals than it is in academic medical centers as it is in Boston. You know, in Boston, in the academic medical centers, there are very strong chairs of surgery that have oversight over all of the surgeons in their department. And their QA and QI process is very robust, and those surgeons are accountable to the chair. It's a little bit less so in private institutions where the chairs have less influence.
Okay. Sorry. No, go ahead. I was just following along with you, a little less influence. So let me ask you this. QA, just you use two acronyms there that I want to make sure people can follow with you. QA is quality assurance. QI is?
Quality improvement.
Okay.
So most hospitals have a very robust way of collecting patient outcome data, identifying problems, and then getting all the stakeholders together to review what the issues were and then to solve the problem. And if that means putting surgeons under, a little tighter control or having some kind of remediation, that is part of the process. And it really failed in this case that he was allowed to continue on as long as he did.
So Dr. Hanto, we're speaking here with Dr. Douglas Hanto, co-chair of the Surgical Ethics Working Group at the Harvard Medical School Center for Bioethics. Here in Massachusetts, as I understand it, we have fail-safes that begin with medical training and then go through the types of fail-safes that you just outlined should happen at a hospital. And then there are also boards, like there's a licensing board. So can you just give us sort of the four or five bullets of the various fail safes that are in place in Massachusetts?
Well, first of all, at the hospital level, As I mentioned, there are quality assurance and quality improvement people that are monitoring the outcomes. That's first. Second, there's accountability to the chairs of surgery and also to the leaders of the institution, including the board of directors. Third, there is the board of registration that in Massachusetts is very robust in terms of receiving information on really any kind of malpractice or disciplinary action. They're immediately reported to the board. Not only that, but patients can complain directly to the board about a physician or a surgeon, and the board then contacts the physician or the surgeon and requires a response. And then they determine whether any further action is required, including putting the information on the practitioner's database. And then finally, the board does have the ability to suspend or take away the medical license to practice. There's also a final thing, and that is that in the United States, most surgeons have to be board certified to practice. And the boards also can take away board certification if they become aware of disciplinary actions.
All right. And according to the Massachusetts Board of Registration in Medicine, it took action against 94 physicians in 2021, Dr. Hanto. And we know that they said that there are about 40,000 physicians in Massachusetts. Does that number, that 94, surprise you? You laid out what sounds like a robust process. Is that an indication of quality in the Commonwealth, or is that an indication of it being difficult to bring these concerns forward to the Board of Registration?
Well, I'm not sure I can say, because I don't think we know what the denominator is. Now, for example, at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, where I practiced for many years, we had an internal process of review interventions with physicians prior to it escalating to the level where it would be reported to the board. So in my view, at least at Beth Israel Deaconess, we had a very effective process for identifying problems, remediating them, and preventing them from escalating to the point where they would require board notification or other disciplinary action. And that included having physicians resign from the staff.
So two remaining quick questions for you, Dr. Hanto. First, what's the difference between a mistake and malpractice?
Well, malpractice settlements don't necessarily admit wrong, but they generally indicate that the surgeon has done something wrong or something negligent. I think the important word here is negligence, and I'm not an attorney and I haven't reviewed these cases in detail, but it's certainly many of the cases exposed by the spotlight investigation were clearly negligent, not coming into the hospital for a patient in distress, leaving the hospital before the patient was out of the operating room. I mean, these are clear negligence of the duty to care.
And my last question for you, do you feel comfortable that patients in Massachusetts have adequate protection and adequate recourse for instances of malpractice?
I do. And I think one of the, I think that the board is a very proactive board. And in contrast to New Hampshire, for example, disciplinary actions don't have to be for 30 days before they're reported to the board. They're reported, any disciplinary action must be reported to the board. So I think that we do have a very good system in place. However, I think there is always the question of whether or not physicians do a good job of policing themselves. And I think that we do a pretty good job, but I do think that we could do better.
All right. Dr. Douglas Hanto is professor of surgery emeritus at Harvard Medical School and the co-chair of the Harvard Center for Bioethics' Surgical Ethics Working Group. Dr. Hanto, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we'll bring a second voice in now. Andrew Drew Meyer is here in Studio 2. He is a medical malpractice attorney and the founding partner of the Lubin and Meyer firm in Boston. Drew, thanks for coming to the show.
Good to be here.
Let me just start with your general reactions from what we heard from Dr. Hanto.
Well, I'm actually quite surprised that Dr. Hanto sees this the way he does. there is a severe problem and has been in Massachusetts in policing doctors for as long as I've been practicing. The Board of Registration of Medicine, which is the ultimate licensing authority to deal with complaints of doctors, has been inefficient and inept and one of the worst ranked boards in the country for monitoring substandard medicine.
Who does that ranking?
There's a national organization that lists the amount. The question, the very good question you asked, is 94 doctors disciplined versus 40,000 doctors. Is that a good number? And what are they ranking it on? And what we do is on the state rankings, which is done, it's a national organization, the name of which I'm not exactly sure of, but they do, as ranked, it's always down at the bottom. There was a period of time around 5 or 6 years ago when the board became a little bit more consumer-oriented and they were a little more careful with monitoring substandard medicine. I would venture to guess that of those 94 cases that you just mentioned, virtually none or very few had to do with substandard practice. And the problem is that the board is not effective at monitoring negligence or substandard practice. What it does is it will take care of the doctors who are doing illegal things, over-prescribing drugs, violating boundaries with patients, sexually and otherwise, particularly in psychiatric cases, because they're the quick and dirty kind of cases they can deal with. But from effectively monitoring whether or not they're practicing substandard medicine for the protection of the patients, they don't do a very good job.
So I want to parse a bunch of that out before you go on. But okay. I think it's the Public Citizens Health Research Group that does those national rankings. All right. So when you say substandard, what I feel like you're keying in on is Dr. Hanto at the very end there, Drew, talked about negligence, right? I asked him what's the difference between a mistake and malpractice. That's what you mean by substandard. Is that correct?
I do, yeah. So the legal definition, which you asked Dr. Hanto about, is really the difference between people making mistakes, which is acceptable, or whether or not they do something which is in violation of the standards of care, which are really the rules of the road that doctors go by. And if they've violated some rule or standard that they should be adhering to, that's the negligence. A simple mistake doesn't warrant malpractice.
So how do we get to the point where we've got somebody who's working in surgical ethics who says we're in great shape and somebody, and structurally, I want to point out, we picked a doctor and a malpractice lawyer, right? So we were looking for people who would present us a full gamut of this perspective. Yeah. But how do we get here?
Well, I think it's a great question. And I think Dr. Hanto simply isn't exposed to the numbers and the way in which these matters are handled. The fact of the matter is, and I think he touched on it, a couple of things that he said, if we dove a little bit deeper into it, we would find he talked about the economics of a hospital not wanting to expose its mistakes and its bad players because they think it'll hurt their reputation and therefore hurt their economics and people won't want to come to that hospital. We find that, for instance, it's not information that's readily available or available at all, really, to patients or the public, the morbidity and mortality rounds that go on, which review the types of things that Dr. Hanto was talking about. So even though it's known within the hospital sometimes who the bad players are, it isn't known to the public or the patients. And there's no – what we're looking at is how are the doctors who are policing themselves doing it? Are they adequate or are they protecting each other? And that's what we find more than anything is that they're protecting each other and they've sort of lost their way in what probably brought them into medicine in the beginning, which was to protect the patient and help the patient.
So, you know, we pride ourselves here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts of being a healthcare mecca. You're laying out some real concern about competence in the oversight structure here in the state, ranking quite low, actually. I think my next question for you then is, in general, do we have a fairly healthy, high-quality practitioner network in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
No, it's a great point. And I think that what we do have is we have some outstanding doctors. We have some of the most brilliant doctors, not only in the country but in the world. But we also have pockets of negligence, pockets of doctors in certain hospitals, particularly community hospitals, but also in the – we have – We have many cases against some of the big educational institutions, Mass General, Beth Israel. Beth Israel had a huge amount of problems a number of years ago in regard to infections, something they didn't want to publicize out of their surgical intensive care unit. But they don't want to tell the public about it because that's going to diminish the people that will come to that hospital. And there is competition amongst hospitals, and the cost is great to them if they have bad publicity. So we're really looking at, yes, we have the best and the brightest, but we also have a lot of very bad players. And the problem is that the best and the brightest aren't always willing to point out or clean the house of those people who are the bad players. And they think it's hurting themselves. They're worried about their insurance rates. They're worried about the reputation of their hospitals. And they don't point out the problems that are occurring.
We're talking about medical malpractice in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Speaking now with Drew Meyer, who's a malpractice attorney and founding partner of Lubin and Meyer. So if somebody is concerned about actual negligence or substandard care, what are their steps?
Yeah, well, they have. If they want to know who to pick a doctor, how to find a doctor who isn't been accused of this, I mean, Dr. Hantow pointed out that the Board of Registration has a website which one can go to for settlements. So that's just absolutely inadequate. The cases that are reported to the board, and that end up on websites are only cases that are settled, and they're settled after 4 or 5 years of litigation. And the only thing it reports is that there was a case settled and whether it was above average or below settlement value. That's the only information you get. And that happens after years. So if somebody's practicing substandard medicine, the patient is not aware of the fact and has no place to go to find out what their record of their doctor is, because there is somewhat of a secrecy community amongst the doctors to protect each other. And the Board of Registration really is not, as it should be, a consumer-oriented group. It's really overseen by the Board of by the Mass Medical Society, which is a group that's out there really to protect the doctors. And they stack it with people who are protecting doctors. And there's one person on there who's a person who's supposed to be the consumer advocate, and the rest are all doctors.
So Drew, you're painting a very dark picture.
Correct.
Here, right?
Yep.
And I love that
I
response.
Am.
Yes, I
yep.
am.
Yep.
So, and again, we had Dr. Douglas Hantow earlier from Harvard Medical School, who painted a different picture.
Mm-hmm.
If you could give one piece of advice to somebody who says, okay, I'm a little anxious now, I'm going to get some care that's important to me,
mm-hmm.
how do I make sure I get optimal care or don't get substandard care? What's one step you would recommend patients take?
A lot of word of mouth, I think, is the best. I always say, you know, you can find out more about your toaster oven or your microwave or your refrigerator than you can about your doctor in Massachusetts, which is unfortunate. So what you need to do is you need to talk to people who have been treated with a doctor. I wouldn't go to the online reviews because those are stacked and aren't particularly effective. There are ways, but it's very sophisticated to find out how many lawsuits are brought against doctors, not how many settlements or how many make the website. But you need to talk to people who have been treated by the particular doctor.
So word of mouth.
That word of mouth is probably the best way, and results.
All right. So Drew Meyer is a malpractice attorney and founding partner of the Lubin and Meyer Law Firm in Boston. Thanks for joining us to talk about medical malpractice here.
Okay, my pleasure.
A major local news institution is about to go through a big change, and it could affect what stories you hear from them about your own community. Brian McGrory is stepping down as editor of the Boston Globe after 10 years in the role. He went from paperboy to reporter and columnist to man in charge in his career and guided the Globe during a time where it faced existential threats. Media analyst John Carroll has long advocated for the importance of strong local news outlets. He's been following this story, joins us now. John, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
So in general, John, how important is an editor, which is the role Brian McGrory had, to a local newspaper?
Well, the editor is very important. The editor sets the tone. The editor runs the newsroom, basically oversees the newsroom. And the editor sets the agenda for what the newspaper is going to do. So the editor is important. We saw Brian McGrory's predecessor, Marty Baron, was really significant in terms of investigating the Catholic Church. I mean, he came in from out of town and basically said, what's going on with the church here? And there was a newsroom that seemed to be a little reluctant to go after the Archdiocese of Boston. Marty Baron said, that's not going to work. He set that tone for the newsroom. Brian McGorry went in and said, look, you know, times are different now. We don't want to be the paper of record. We want to be the paper of interest. We want to give readers just what they want and what they need to know.
What does that mean, the difference between a paper of record and a paper of interest, John?
The paper of record is basically going into the weeds and recording virtually everything that the government is doing, municipal government, state government. It basically tries to establish itself as the voice of authority in terms of what is happening in a community. You look at the New York Times. You know, the New York Times has a very different agenda from the Boston Globe, and the Boston Globe is a regional newspaper. It's a large regional newspaper, but it has a different audience and a different mandate in many ways of what to cover. So the Boston Globe wanted to be less sort of dry, process-driven, and more human interest-driven. And that's one of the things that Brian McGorry brought to them.
And do you feel, John Carroll, that Brian McGorry achieved that? If you look at how the Boston Globe has reported over the last decade versus times before, is it more a paper of interest than a paper of record? And we'll get to the word paper in a minute.
I think that's a matter of opinion. I will say that under Brian McGorry, the Boston Globe won 3 Pulitzer Prizes. So there's that on that side of the ledger. Everybody has a different sense of what they want a newspaper to deliver. If you look at the Boston Herald audience, you know, they're looking for something that's much more ideologically driven than perhaps the Boston Globe. The readership is really different. And I think that what the Boston Globe readers are looking for is something that is relevant to them and something that is lively enough to retain their interest. And I think that the Globe has delivered that to some degree.
All right. We're talking with media analyst John Carroll about the changing of the editorial guard at the Boston Globe. So Brian McGorry comes in. As you said, he replaces Marty Baron. He left the Globe to head the Washington Post. He's, as you noted, he's credited with unveiling the Catholic abuse scandal. In fact, Liev Schreiber played him in the Academy Award winning film Spotlight. So those are big shoes to fill. Here's a little bit from Brian McGorry in a Globe promo a year before he was named editor about his love for newspapers.
Back in fifth grade, when I was growing up in Weymouth, we formed a student government in social studies class, and some kids ran for president, other kids ran for the student senate. I opened up my own newspaper. It's the only thing I ever wanted to do, and oddly enough, the only place I ever wanted to do it was at the Boston Globe.
So he spends decades at the Globe, and he takes over as editor at a really critical time, John Carroll. Let's go back a decade, 2012. Local newspapers all around the country are closing. The Boston Globe is financially in trouble. Take us to that moment.
Right. Well, let's go back even a little bit further. Go back to 1993 when the New York Times paid $1.1 billion for the Boston Globe. At that time, the Boston Globe's daily circulation was about 504,000. Sunday was 811,000. It was routine for the Sunday edition to be 500, 550 pages. You went to the Boston Globe to do so many things back then. You went there if you wanted a job, if you needed an apartment, if you wanted to buy a used lawnmower, if you wanted to buy a puppy. All those things were happening in the Boston Globe classified. By 2013, when Brian McGorry takes over,
20 years later,
their circulation is cut in half. It's down to 245,000, the print edition. It's obviously the internet age has come and basically decoupled advertising from editorial at newspapers. This is happening all over the country, and it's just accelerated from there. So this is a problem that John Henry comes in the next year, in 2014. This is a problem that John Henry and Brian McGorry needed to solve, because things were changing so dramatically that that they needed to figure out how to monetize digital content, because they had been giving it away up to then. They thought, you know, they thought the web was the caboose. You know, they found out that the web is the engine.
Is the engine. And I just want to note, that's Boston Red Sox owner John Henry. He bought the newspaper from the New York Times.
Right. He bought it for $70 million.
Let's just underscore. You say the New York Times buys it in 93 for $1.1 billion.
Right.
And then
John Henry buys it for $70 million. So that's, what, 7 cents on the dollar? Not that good at math. But
the Globe makes the pivot then over the next decade.
The Globe starts to make the pivot. But even in 2019, they only had 95,000 digital subscribers. Now it's up to 235,000. But their print circulation is down to 65,000 daily. So you've gone from 504,000 to 65,000. And actually, for those of you keeping score at home, the Herald in 1993 had a daily circulation of 337,000. Today, it's about 20,000.
And this is the print circulation.
This is the print circulation. On the other hand, the Globe gets 55% of its revenues from the print edition. So even in this diminished capacity, the print edition is really the cash cow for the Boston Globe. So at some point, it's going to tip. And it's going to tip so that it's more expensive to produce the print edition than it is to get rid of it. And when it's more expensive to produce it than the revenue that it brings in, that's probably when you'll see an all-digital Boston Globe.
We're speaking with John Carroll, media analyst, about the change in editorial leadership at the Boston Globe. So, John, Brian McGorry hasn't been without controversy, including disputed allegations about inappropriate texts between McGorry and former Boston.com reporter Hillary Sargent in 2018. The Globe conducted their own internal investigation and decided that McGorry hadn't violated any anti-harassment policies. Sargent maintained that was a faulty finding. I also want to point out, under his leadership, the Globe failed to disclose departures of an employee over harassment claims when reporting on other key harassment stories, including when it reported on hostile workplace allegations against former WBUR employee Tom Ashbrook. So just in the overall scheme of the legacy, where will this chapter fit for Brian McGorry as editor?
Well, it'll always be attached to him. And there are many people, there are people who believe that it was a whitewash by the Globe. One of the problems was that the initial text message that Hillary Sargent published on Twitter did not have a date on it. So it was not clear when it actually was sent. She was an intern at the Globe in 1998 and 1999, at which point she and Brian McGorry had a dating relationship. She was a writer-editor at Boston.com 2014 to 2016. So it was unclear whether she was an employee of the Globe when that text message was sent or not. Hillary Sargent said, "I went in and talked to them for 7 hours. I showed them and I demonstrated inappropriate activity, behavior by Brian McGorry by text, email, and in personal relationships, and they did nothing. It was a whitewash. So this will always be attached to Brian McGorry, and really, to many people, it just wasn't settled in a satisfactory way."
So two last quick questions for you, John. McGorry is headed to Boston University to lead the journalism school. Boston University holds the license on WBUR, although we're editorially independent. What do you expect to see change at the BU School of Journalism?
Well, the journalism department at BU has always been more traditional than cutting edge. At least that's the reputation that it has. So I think Brian McGorry going in there is going to bring them a little more experience in terms of the balance of traditional and forward-looking journalism, the kind of thing that he has tried to achieve at the Globe.
And what are you looking for in the next editor of the Boston Globe? What do you think is important?
It's going to be interesting to see. There are some people who think bring in somebody young and edgy, like a Wesley Lowery, who formerly at the Washington Post, or Sewell Chan, formerly at the New York Times. I think it's likely that it's not going to be a white male, because that's been the tradition all along. But I'm not sure how cutting edge or how edgy the choice will be. I think there are a couple of managing editors there who might be kicked upstairs. But it'll be interesting to see. It'll say something about what the Henrys, John and Linda Henry, want to do in terms of the future of the paper.
All right. Media analyst John Carroll joining us there. John, thanks.
Thank you.
The New England Patriots kicked off their regular season yesterday in Miami. Where they always seem to struggle, and yesterday was no different.
The Dolphins are going to run a play here.
Yeah, I think I don't know if I really love this decision.
Over the middle, got his man, and look at him go! Jalen Waddle for the touchdown!
Ugh, that score made it 17-0 at the half, and the rest, well, you know how it goes. So here to break it down for us, our expert panel from last Friday's show, where we said we'd bring you the results, and now maybe I'm a little sorry we are. Jonathan Marshall is a sports reporter for WMUR in Manchester. Jonathan, welcome back.
How's it going, guys?
Well, better days. And Chris Siderick from WBUR here in Studio 2. Chris, hey there.
Yeah, I agree with the play-by-play. Wish they hadn't made the decision to run that before the half. Brutal.
Yeah. So, John, let's start with you. What did you see yesterday in the New England Patriots?
Pretty much a carryover from the preseason and what we talked about. I mean, the glaring issue from what I've noticed for the past couple years with this team, obviously post Tom Brady, of course, but a lack of dynamic playmaking ability. So, right, everything is not going to be perfect, right? And so what can you point to say, okay, despite the foundation not being solid, despite everything not being perfect, where can we go to at least rise above the lack of a foundation, the lack of a solid foundation? Is it the quarterback? Is it playmaking at the wideout position, the running back position? None of that is there. And so when you have these issues with the offensive play calling, when you have these issues with the O-line, it gets even more compounded, and there's no dynamic talent out there to rise above that. And that's what we're seeing, especially yesterday.
So a couple of things I want to pick up on there, and I'll turn to you, Chris Siderick. So for example, John just talked about the O-line. We had twice in the first half of the game where the quarterback, Mac Jones, the guy that throws the ball, right, just gets destroyed by somebody whose job is to try to tackle him, and there's no one covering him. That's called the blitz.
Yeah.
And as John's saying, there's nobody who can sort of, out of the pure force of their dynamism and athleticism, overcome those bad moments.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a brilliant observation, but we don't have Tom Brady to cover the faults anymore, right? You don't have one of the greatest to ever play who can kind of rise up when the situation's not perfect and find a way to make it happen. And we talked on Friday about they're changing their offensive scheme, and so these linemen don't necessarily know who they're supposed to block, where they're supposed to go. And that is so scary when you've got a second-year quarterback you're really hoping will take that leap and become kind of a leader on this team. You got to protect him, right? He went out with an injury, and I'll maybe get to that later. But, yeah, I think we saw exactly what we were afraid we were going to see on
Sunday. So, John, I am fascinated by always about the way that when we watch a sport like football play out, the choices that you make, the team that you have. I think everybody can understand this from their own lives, right? We're trying to get something done. Maybe we don't have all the players we want. Now we've got a boss who's making decisions I just don't understand, and I'm not confident. Did we see any increase in confidence for of people for Bill Belichick, who was really puzzling people before this first game about what is he doing and why is he doing it?
I think the questions are even had compounded even more.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, how can you watch that display? There's no excuses at this point. You have a full preseason, a full training camp, and all the messages from the media press conference in the preseason is questioning just where are the play calls coming from? Who's making these decisions? And Belichick says the responsibility is on him. You know, so you have to look at Belichick when it comes to just the roster construction, just the decision to hire Matt Patricia, who is a defensive guy, to take control of the offensive situation, and Joe Judge included. And so Chris just said, when it comes to Mac Jones being a young quarterback, that concerns me the most in year two in his development. Yes. Does he have a ceiling? He's not Tom Brady. He's not, you know, he's not physically talented compared to some of the other quarterbacks that you may see around this league, but you have to foster an environment to where he can reach his potential. I don't think Bill Belichick is doing that at all.
Yeah, John, I would add to that too. I think we had all these kind of big picture questions and critiques of Belichick's approach in the offseason and the preseason, but then we got some granular stuff yesterday. Like I know I'm not the only one that was kind of baffled. Kendrick Bourne, one of the team's best receivers, basically didn't play until you got more than halfway into the fourth quarter. He comes in, he's in for one play, and he catches a 41-yard bomb, and then they pull him out right away. So it's you got to wonder, like, why wasn't he on the field? Why didn't they try using him? And like I said, I wasn't the only one asking this. Belichick had this exchange with reporters after the game. Tiziana, you know I love bringing you some electric Bill Belichick sound.
Some rowdy Bill Belichick.
So
here,
let's take a listen to whether or not it was an intentional decision not to play Kendrick Bourne.
No, it just worked out that way.
Came in and immediately caught a 40-yard pass. In retrospect, he was playing more than.
We do what we thought was best.
Was it disciplinary?
No.
So insightful, right?
Right. And John, I want to turn to you about that because, again, sticking with this analogy of, you know, you work on a team or in an organization, you want to know what your boss is doing. Bill Belichick used to get a pass on not answering these questions. Is he going to be able to keep up with the tight-lipped mumble-mumble no answers? Or is there an accountability moment coming for him?
When you're not winning, the things that were excused before won't be excused. and that exchange right there is showing you right there. And you got to think, right, if you're in that locker room or any organization, any place on the job where your manager or boss, whatever, is making questionable decisions, how is that going to trickle down for the entire team, right? Are you going to block as hard? Are you going to perform as hard? Like, there's going to be a lot of confusion. Like, what is this person doing? What are they thinking? So you got to think about the locker room and what is that reflecting on you? Like, he says that the guy who probably is your most explosive option, most explosive weapon offensively when it comes to being a wideout, makes a play. And we felt the best decision for this team was to not play him until that moment. It's not looking good. It's not looking good. And as a locker room, as an organization, you got to wonder mentally where this team is at right now and questioning possibly what Bill Belichick is even thinking. And is he putting this team truly in the right position to succeed?
We're talking with Jonathan Marshall of WMUR and Chris Siderick of WBUR. John, you made me worry about Mac Jones in a way that I had not been thinking about before. Maybe a little bit of the mother in me about this young person who's supposed to be developing. And so, Chris, I'll turn to you here because you also made reference to the fact that he went and got an X-ray after the game.
Yeah, test results were negative. He traveled back with the team. They were going to do some further testing today, and Bill Belichick was actually asked about that at a virtual press conference today. Here was his wonderful update.
No update on Mac. We'll see how he is today. But, you know, he came back with us, so we'll see. We'll see how that goes. And, that's about the news from yesterday.
I mean, imagine having to take that seriously as a reporter. It's brutal. But I think even if he is okay, it just shows the concerns that we were talking about on Friday. You cannot afford to lose this guy that you're trying to build your franchise around, and they are not doing what it takes to protect him.
So, John, this is both depressing and compelling, right? For those who are kind of intrigued by what we're watching unfold, if they want to watch this next game, what's one thing you advise people to watch for other than whether or not Mac Jones is in the game?
Can they protect Mac? I mean, if Mac Jones is in the game, can they protect him? But also, offensively, there has to be some semblance of an identity, right? Like, without an identity, you know, do you know where you're going? There's nothing but confusion, right? And so I want to see if there's some sort of identity that this team can put together. Offensively, I mean, to put up a 0 points through two quarters is inexcusable. So offensively, we have to figure out what this team is. Are they a run team? Can they get some things going in the pass game? They have to figure out their identity and go from there. That's the first step, figuring out what this team's identity is for 2022.
And Chris Siderick, can they do that against a team like the Steelers?
I mean, they should be able to. The Steelers are not supposed to be good this year. They did end up squeaking out a win yesterday in overtime. So I don't know. I can't take anything for granted with this team anymore. For 20 years, we could assume the Patriots were probably going to win on Sundays. Those days are long gone.
All right, WBUR's Chris Siderick and Jonathan Marshall, who's sports reporter for WMUR. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to stick with the sports theme now, but we're going to turn to running, because if you're hoping to run this year's Boston Marathon, it's time to pull the trigger. Registration starts today and continues through the week. Here with us now in Studio 2, welcoming back Alex Ashlock. He's covered the marathon for WBUR since 1998 and has become, I feel like, kind of my personal guide to the marathon as well.
Well, that's nice of you to say.
Welcome back, Alex.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for not asking me about the Patriots or the Red Sox.
Oh, we're not talking about the Red Sox today. All right, so registration does start today for the 2023 Boston Marathon. Tell people what they need to know.
You know, it's open until 5 p.m. on Friday. There used to be, or there has been in recent years, a lot of angst for folks that wanted to try to get into the next year's marathon. For many years, you had to have a faster time than your qualifying time to get into the race. That didn't happen this year. Everybody who had a qualifying time and who tried to sign up got into the race. So we'll see if that happens again for the 2023 race. So people are, runners are poised at their computers, signing up, and hopefully they'll all get in.
All right. So, and when you, I'm intrigued by this. So what you mean is it used to be so hard to get in that your qualifying time wasn't good enough.
You had
to be
have,
able to run better than
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Your qualifying time, I think in the 2021 race, your qualifying time had to be something like 5 or 6 minutes faster just to get into the marathon. That didn't happen for this year's race for probably a variety of reasons. And one of them was probably there just that weren't that many other qualifying races to run because of the pandemic. There weren't any big marathons. So we'll see if that happens again for 2023.
And I do want to note, of course, last year at this time, runners were finishing off their training plans, getting ready for a fall Boston Marathon. Next year, back to Patriots
back to
Day,
spring,
April 17th. Yep. So for those counting, what are the biggest differences between running in the spring, when we usually do,
yep,
and running in the fall?
Well, if you're training for a fall marathon, especially around here this summer, you've run in the brutal heat getting ready for that fall marathon. If you're doing a spring marathon, usually you start training around Christmas time, December, and here in Boston, you're running in the wintertime, obviously. It can be freezing cold, there can be snow, and then you don't know what it's going to be like in April in Boston, as
because
you
know. Because it might be like 85 degrees.
It might be 90 degrees.
50.
There might be a monsoon like there was in 2018. So basically, you just have to put in the miles, regardless of when your marathon is, and then you see what race day's like.
And then you just wait and see. And of course, we can have zero predictions on that because I don't even know what tomorrow's weather's really going to be like.
No.
All right. I do want to turn to this other piece, Alex. I find this fascinating. So this other really big marathon-related news. John Hancock announced that the race in April 2023, will be their last race as the lead corporate sponsor in partnership with the Boston Athletics Association, the BAA, which runs it.
Mm-hmm.
That feels like a really big deal, Alex.
I think it is a big deal, but you're talking about a partnership that lasted for nearly 40 years. Nothing lasts forever. Things are changing all the time. John Hancock was purchased by a Toronto-based company, I think, in 2004. Maybe they're looking to a more global vision, perhaps. There might have been a sign that this was coming. I think it was last year. John Hancock was in charge of assembling the elite field for the race every year. They had a person that whose job it was to liaison with the athletes and make the arrangements for them to be part of the field. John Hancock gave that up and turned it over to the Boston Athletic Association last year. So it's the BAA now that makes up, you know, gets the athletes to come here and run. So maybe that was a sign that John Hancock was going to step back.
Well, I also wonder, you know, them letting go of their iconic billboard picture of, you know, John Hancock at Fenway Park, which they also announced they're not going to continue to pay for. That does feel like a pretty big change.
Yeah, I think that's another big change. And again, it's just a sign, I think, that John Hancock is changing.
So that is part of a 40-year transformation,
really,
though,
yes.
Alex. So talk about that. How has the marathon changed over those nearly 40 years?
Well, I wasn't here in the 80s, but believe it or not, the marathon started to not be such a big deal.
Hmm.
And one of the reasons was they didn't offer any prize money. So there was a executive from John Hancock, David Alessandro, Boston Mayor Ray Flynn got involved, and they worked up a sponsorship deal that paid millions of dollars to get it started. Marathon historian Tom Dedarian told the Globe last week that a key point in this was that they didn't call it the John Hancock Boston Marathon. It was just the Boston Marathon. You see these other big marathons, they have sponsors' names on them. That never happened with the Boston Marathon. So it started in 1986. I think the first prize money was something like $30,000 for the winner of the race. And it's grown into this massive marathon that's known worldwide, and the winners receive $150,000 each for winning.
Well, and I want to note, I went back and looked, and in the early 80s, at the beginning of this partnership, you'd see 7,000, mm-hmm. 8,000 runners yep. registered. Now we're talking about nearly 30,000.
Yep.
And this last year, more than $35 million raised for charity, which, as I understand it, also a significant change over the last few decades.
Yeah, John Hancock, people from John Hancock, workers from John Hancock are part of those charities. And, you know, they've raised hundreds of millions of dollars over the charity program over the years. So John Hancock's been a huge part of the Boston Marathon for nearly 40 years.
So could this affect the runners?
You know, it won't affect the everyday runners, the folks who, you know, are out there running 3-4 hour marathons. It could affect the elite runners, just in terms of whether, you know, the sponsorship is going to be the same, and will the prize money be the same, and will it be as attractive to come here and run to compete for $150,000 if you're the winner? You know, not in each field in the marathon, you know, there's probably 5 or 10 people who can win the race. So, you know, everybody's not going to win $150,000. But for the really big runners, the world-class runners, you know, that's a big payday, $150,000. So hopefully the marathon can attract a sponsor, a principal sponsor, that will be able to foot the bill for that.
We're talking to WBUR marathon reporter Alex Ashlak. You know, I remember when John Hancock was sold to Manulife in Toronto. That was during a stretch in the early aughts, with lots of concern about loss of corporate headquarters here that would mean less
sure.
money coming into our civic life. Are you worried about the BAA, Alex, being able to find another sponsor for the Boston Marathon?
You know, they do have a lot of other sponsors. Of course, smaller amounts of money, smaller deals they have. This might be an opportunity. I'm not a marketing expert, but this might be an opportunity for the BAA to look at a different type of company, or, you know, some sort of social media platform or something like that. I think maybe they don't need one principal sponsor potentially anymore. Maybe it could be a combination of smaller groups, you know, able to put together the prize money that they need to attract those really elite runners every year.
All right, last question for you, Alex. We have been on a journey together from when we talked on air about whether there would be a Boston Marathon in the first COVID year to there wasn't, and then it was delayed again, and then a fall marathon. Next year, quote-unquote, normal marathon, April 2023. What are you most excited about?
Well, you know, the thing I want to see most of all is Eliud Kipchoge run a marathon here. He's the world's greatest marathoner by far. If he were to add a Boston Marathon victory to his resume, there would be no debate about who the best marathon runner ever is or was. He's running Berlin on September 25th. Certainly gives him enough time to come back and run a Boston in April. So I'd love to see him here.
Well, if he does, we'll talk to you about it.
We will.
That's Alex Ashlak, who has reported on the Boston Marathon for WBUR since 1998. Alex, thanks.
You're welcome.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.